This episode of Navarra Live is brought to you by listeners like you. Thank you.
Welcome to a Friday night edition of Navarra Live. I'm Michael Walker and I'm joined by Aaron Bastani. Aaron, how are you doing?
Michael, very well. Thank you very much. Always a pleasure, particularly with this gorgeous bank holiday weather we appear to be having. I don't rule out a bit of rain this weekend, but for now, I'm in a great mood.
I feel like I'm missing out now because we just got these sort of black curtains. I've got no idea what it looks like outside. Hopefully, I'll be out there soon. We're having a somewhat musical show today. So we're going to be playing you some music I made on AI at the end of the show. We're going to start the show by talking about Eurovision. As you can imagine, being this Navarra Live, Navarra Media, and there is very much a political angle to both stories. The Eurovision one, I imagine you can guess at the end. We are going to be talking about whether AI will steal all of our jobs. And in the middle of the show, we'll have a discussion, an explainer about the Channel crossings. There have been record numbers of asylum seekers risking their lives to cross the English Channel this year. Let's go straight on to that first story. Ollie Alexander has rejected calls from 450 queer artists, individuals and organisations to boycott Eurovision due to the participation of Israel. The Years and Years singer, also an actor, is the UK's entrant at the competition, and creatives including Maxine Peake and Sarah Schulman had sent him this open letter calling for him to withdraw. So it said, "We share the vision of queer joy and abundance you've offered through your music and share your belief in collective liberation for all. In this spirit, we ask you to heed the Palestinian call to withdraw from Eurovision. There can be no party with a state committing apartheid and genocide. At a time when accountability is so urgently needed, Israel's inclusion in Eurovision would enable and cover up its war crimes and crimes against humanity." Now, today, Ollie Alexander has responded to that call. So I'm on his various social media accounts. He put up this message: "I wholeheartedly support action being taken to demand an immediate and permanent ceasefire in Gaza, the return of all hostages, and the safety and security of all civilians in Palestine and Israel. I know some people will choose to boycott this year's Eurovision, and I understand and respect their decision. As a participant, I've taken a lot of time to deliberate over what to do and the options available to me. It is my current belief that removing myself from the contest wouldn't bring us any closer to our shared goal." And he goes on, "Instead, I've been speaking with some of the other Eurovision contestants, and we've decided that by taking part, we can use our platform to come together and call for peace. I hope and pray that our calls are answered and there is an end to the atrocities we are seeing taking place in Gaza. I'd like to thank the many signatories of this letter whose work I deeply admire and respect, and hope that we can continue to work together in creating a better world for all of us." So essentially, he's not going to boycott Eurovision. He doesn't think boycotting Eurovision will, you know, make a material change to the genocidal war in Gaza. Now, you know, that's not necessarily unreasonable. Would it make a material change to the genocidal war in Gaza? I'm not sure. But I suppose what lots of people are asking is, what can they do? If there's even a small chance that what they do could have that effect, you know, that should be taken seriously. He mentioned there that while he will be performing and taking part, he was sort of signing a joint statement from himself and several other Eurovision artists, so contenders from other countries. "This is that statement. We want to begin by acknowledging the privilege of taking part in Eurovision. In light of the current situation in the occupied Palestinian territories, and particularly in Gaza and in Israel, we do not feel comfortable being silent." That sentence is, "and particularly in Gaza and in Israel." So what's the point in particularly if you've got both? Anyway, "we do not feel comfortable being silent. It is important to us to stand in solidarity with the oppressed and communicate our heartfelt wish for peace, an immediate and lasting ceasefire, and the safe return of all hostages." This is something that basically, you know, anyone can agree with. You know, the Israeli government could kind of agree with that because you've got this list where all are conditional on the other or could be conditional on the other. And then they say, "we stand united against all forms of hate, including anti-Semitism and Islamophobia. We firmly believe in the unifying power of music, enabling people to transcend differences and foster meaningful conversations and connections. We feel that it is our duty to create and uphold this space, with a strong hope that it will inspire greater compassion and empathy." Aaron, you know, some people in our audience might be saying, why are you leading this show with Eurovision? I mean, we are going to talk later about sort of South African boycotts and how cultural boycotts have been effective in the past. I mean, it's Israel's participation in Eurovision, which has sort of created this big push for a boycott. I mean, for a start, it's not even in Europe. So it's sort of this guest contestant in the Euro. It's sort of getting these special privileges as a friend of Europe, I suppose. And in a period while it is committing a genocidal war in Gaza, people think that artists withdrawing to show their disgust at that would be a good idea. Ollie Alexander is saying, no, I'm going to make this statement. But then this statement by the 9 Eurovision contestants, completely meaningless. We feel that it is our duty to create and uphold this space. What space? What does that mean? You know, I find it bizarre that someone would think it was worthwhile releasing a statement as sort of meaningless as that.
Well, it's pseudo-activist speak, isn't it? I mean, clearly anybody with some moral sort of commitments to opposing war, opposing death, opposing needless brutality would not be doing this. And I understand there's been a conversation around boycotts, divestment, sanctions. We'll talk about all of that, like you say, in a few moments' time. But particularly on boycotts, you know, I don't really see the argument against the boycott of Israel right now. You know, we could have had the argument 3-4 years ago. You'd say, well, it's an apartheid state. True. It's based on ethnic cleansing and the Nakba. True. And you might be able to park all of that, as Ollie Alexander is presently trying to do alongside these other contestants, and say, yes, but we want to maintain a certain kind of cultural dialogue with the Israeli public, even though most of them absolutely agree with apartheid, for XYZ reasons. I don't agree with that, but it's a coherent argument, Michael. I'm sure many of our audience don't agree with that, listening and watching right now. But it's remotely coherent, okay? And, you know, in some contexts, I would agree with it for other countries, for instance. I think, for instance, it's very important to actually keep a cultural dialogue with the Iranian public. I don't agree with sanctions on Iran. Boycotts are something quite different. Again, we'll return to that. But when there is an active war going on, being prosecuted by the state of Israel against a non-state entity, which is what Palestine is. You know, people like to say, how would we respond? This is a non-state actor. This is not a war between two sovereign countries where at least 15,000 kids have died. We've seen every single day video and photo evidence of war crimes, atrocities. The overt language of Israeli politicians is collective punishment, which is a war crime. You know, this is not an opinion. That is often how they couch the defenses of what they're doing in collective punishment. We'll stop doing this when the hostages come back. Well, you know, these 9-year-old children starving, or that newborn infant who was maimed, that they have nothing to do with the hostages. So that is collective punishment. And the idea that you'd anyway seek to give that legitimacy, which is what is happening if you go and perform in Eurovision, I think is outrageous. And of course, you're welcome to do that. If you're saying, look, I don't really care, I don't know enough, I think that's morally abhorrent, you're welcome to do that. What I find particularly galling is this kind of, like I say, pseudo-activist speak, pretending to be pious and care about virtue and care about ethics and care about the oppressed and the exploited. And at the same time, like I say, you're furnishing a state responsible for killing 15,000 children plus with legitimacy. We've seen videos of, you know, a young girl, Michael, this one was stuck in my mind for a very long time, telling her cat, if and when I die, please don't eat me. I mean, it sounds like something from, you know, Cormac McCarthy, you know, The Road. It sounds like something from a dystopian horror film you wouldn't want a child to see. That's a child's experience. We've seen people being squashed like fruit and vegetables under the tracks of tanks. You know, I was raised to think that this brave protester in Tiananmen Square standing up to a tank, this embodied what civil society can do when it confronts an overbearing state. He stood up to the tank. The tanks are rolling over the people right now in Gaza. So I have absolutely zero time for anyone who says actually they don't need to do a boycott because they want to create a space or a conversation or a dialogue. This is not the time for that point. It's nonsense. It's stupid. It's morally vacuous.
I've seen some people in the comments sort of suggest, which I think is right, the only way you could really say this is if you end your song by waving a Palestinian flag and sort of speaking out against the genocide, because saying we're going to hold this space and say we want peace in the Middle East, which is just meaningless. And it's just, there's no point in holding space to say that. This year's Eurovision will be in stark contrast to the competition in 2022. Back then, Russia were banned from participating due to their invasion of Ukraine. And at the event itself, this happened.
We have a winner!
The winner
of the Eurovision Song Contest 2022! is Ukraine!
Thank you so much. Thank you for supporting Ukraine. This victory is for every Ukrainian.
Slava Ukraini!
Now, I actually thought that was a good moment, right? I like the Ukrainian song. Russia had just illegally invaded Ukraine. I think it was good that they were banned from that competition. I think it was good that the sort of the European public voted in and supported Ukraine. And I don't know if you all know how the system works, but it starts with the judges giving sort of everyone some points, and then the public gives everyone some points. And I think the UK were actually number one that year from the judges, but then the public overwhelmingly voted for Ukraine. I mean, partly because the song was good, but I think mainly because they wanted to sort of show a signal of solidarity to a country that had just been invaded. I think that was good, right? I think that should happen again, but in this context where there is a war which is just as deadly, more deadly if you're talking about civilians, of one country against, as Aaron says, a non-state actor in this respect. I think definitely more children have been killed in Gaza than were killed in Ukraine. Aaron, it'll be interesting to see how many votes Israel gets, right? Because these are very political, sort of the Eurovision Song Contest. My concern, my worry is that you obviously can't vote against a country. You can only vote for a country. So even if only, you know, 10% of the European public are pro-Israel, but if they're really pro-Israel, then you could still see Israel do quite well. I mean, the Germans, they're probably all going to be voting for Israel. Not all of them, but, you know, lots of them. It could, in a way, you know, end up being a propaganda coup for them.
Look, the German government these days, Michael, is so wacky. I wouldn't be surprised if Scholz or Baerbock, that nutty foreign minister they've got, if they didn't say, if you don't vote for Israel in the Eurovision Song Contest, you're anti-Semitic. It's German values to vote for Israel. These fucking mad people. Where to begin with this? I would imagine Israel would still come last, Michael. What you said at the top of the story, by the way, they're not in Europe. I find this such a strange thing, but it's not something we should just gloss over. You know, the status of Israel as this country which claims to be, when it's convenient for it, European, and when it's convenient for it, Middle Eastern and non-European, is intentional. It is intentional. I can't see the Irish giving them many points, Michael. I mean, my goodness, imagine if Israel finished above the UK. That would be bad. We've had some bad songs in our time, but look, I also sort of disagree, Michael, on the point you said about Ukraine, and I thought it was good. I find this sort of just stupid. I mean, I might be wrong. But the idea that Ukraine as a country, tens of millions of Ukrainians could draw succor from the fact that, okay, we're freezing. Yes, we're being bombed. Yes, my son's just been conscripted. Yes, I've just been displaced. Yes, my best friends have had to flee the country. But it's okay because we've won Eurovision. I just find it really silly. And I know nobody's saying that, but you're saying it was like a symbol or a gesture of solidarity. I'm obviously getting old because I just find this kind of stuff ridiculous. And the people that get like really gleeful and excited about it, oh yeah, Ukraine, like Eurovision. I just think, what the hell are you, like, this isn't serious politics. If you believe in a gesture of solidarity and you think they have to win at all costs, lobby your political representative to arm them. I get that. Eurovision. I mean, if I was a Russian nativist, ultra-nationalist Putin supporter, I would laugh at that. This is how the Europeans are going to help Ukraine. They're going to let them win Eurovision. Okay. Boo-hoo. So, you know, maybe we disagree there, Michael. A rare point of disagreement here on Navarro Live on a Friday evening, but there you are.
The winning of Eurovision itself, I mean, in a way, you know, the way we're framing Eurovision is that it matters to some degree, right? Because we're saying that it would make a difference if Oleg Alexander were to boycott it, right? So we're saying it does have some significance as a symbolic event. We're going to talk about South Africa, where lots of these sort of events were very significant. I would say, in terms of did it matter with Ukraine? So the Ukrainians, the main thing that they need is for European publics to continue supporting their fight, right? Because the big fear for Ukraine is that Russia is a big country. It can sort of fund its own war. Ukraine is much smaller. It needs outside support. And so it really needs to maintain some enthusiasm, especially in Europe, also in North America, to fund their fight back against the Russians. So I would say that actually the symbolic gesture of the European public coming together and saying, we support Ukraine, is potentially quite meaningful. I'm not sure that is merely symbolic.
I mean, I'll respond to that quickly. So I think it's actually qualitatively different, because you might say, well, Aaron, why are you saying that about Ukraine, but then saying, you know, Israel shouldn't be at Eurovision or whatever, or people should be boycotting it? I think actually this is precisely the kind of action which is very problematic for Israel because they want to normalize themselves as quote-unquote a Western country, a tourist destination, somewhere where you have social liberal values at the forefront of LGBT rights, even though gay people can't marry there, which, by the way, seems to be glossed over. You get these American actresses and influencers, and they say, I saw one, that Chelsea Handler lady, saying it's LGBT capital. Gay people can't get married there. How's that an LGBT capital? Anyway, I'm not talking about Tel Aviv. She was talking about the country as a whole. This wonderful place at the forefront of LGBT rights. And we're sort of denigrating our own societies and our own values if we say that. But I think undermining this kind of PR exercise of Israel being this forward-looking, progressive, modern, Western country, even if you're quite ambivalent or skeptical of those terms, that's how they try and protect themselves. I think artists not doing things like Eurovision, musicians not doing concerts in Israel, academics not doing lectures in Israel, people saying that I don't actually support a Hebrew translation of my book. That is precisely the kind of stuff which it might seem silly, you know? My goodness, they've got F-35s they're using against people. You know, it's the first country in the world to use F-35s. It takes billions of dollars from the United States in military aid. All true. But because of how it's tried to create this niche for itself as an extension of the West in the East or in its near abroad, actually this discrediting of Israeli legitimacy through the culture and social sphere is really, really key. Whereas I think Russia, Michael, doesn't have any illusions of that, right? Russia is not pretending to be a Western country. It doesn't care what the West thinks about it. You'll see Lavrov on X or on, you know, if he's talking to somebody on telly or Medvedev, they will openly say how much they hate Europe. They hate Europeans. They hate the West. They think we're idiots. We're losers. We're morons, etc. Of course, that's a power play, right? Because they're trying to project their own importance, power, ideas, values, and to show that they're superior in some way. Israel isn't doing that. So I do think it's different. And look, people can do what they want. But I think particularly with Ukraine, this is an old-fashioned 20th century style war, which is about industrial capacity. It's about mobilization of literal human beings. And I think in a way, the mindset is still very much on late 20th century, early 21st century. This is actually all about narrative and news and framing and hashtags. Ukraine has nothing to do with hashtags. It's about, you know, the armed capabilities of both sides to fight a long war, which actually resembles the First World War, trench warfare in some instances, and an intensive urban warfare. In a way, you know, Israel-Palestine is different. In so much as it's far more amenable to that kind of activism that I just sort of said is really ineffective in the Russian context.
So I think I would disagree with you there again, actually. But I do think this draws out something very interesting, which sort of has just come to mind, which is, so I think you're right that Israel cares a lot more about legitimation than Russia does, right? Israel wants to portray itself as a normal country that deserves the support of the West because it's part of the West. That's true. Russia doesn't have the same pretensions or the same strategy. You know, that's not what their victory would be based on. But the contested nation in 2022 wasn't Russia, it was Ukraine. Because Ukraine, and I do think that actually hashtag activism is probably as effective when it comes to Ukraine as in Israel for very different reasons. Because in Ukraine, as I was saying earlier, they require support of the West. And so their big PR campaign, now whether or not you sort of agree with this idea of we're part of the West, you might find it sort of distasteful to say we're part of the West, so you should defend us, because it's sort of implying that if you're not part of the West, you shouldn't be defended. But you can see why the Ukrainians were doing it, right? It was in the material interests of the Ukrainians in that war to say, we are part of the West. You need to defend us because we are one of you. We are, you know, at the center of Europe culturally. So I think that probably would have had some impact. We should maybe go on to our next clip, though, Aaron. We could talk about this for a while, but we're going to move on from the 2022 Eurovision Song Contest. It is spring 2024, of course. The topic of boycotts or exclusions from international competitions inevitably brings to mind the successful campaign to boycott and ultimately sanction apartheid South Africa. From 1970 onwards, apartheid South Africa was banned from most international sporting competitions, including the Olympics. Now, the reason for that ban was that South Africa had segregated its sports teams, of course, by race. In 1983, with apartheid still in force, the BBC made this documentary on the effects of that ban.
The black man is like people trapped in a ship, and the ship is about to sink. Black and white, green and yellow. We are prepared to sink with the ship because there is no better world for us until our authorities in Pretoria listen to us.
Well, it does seem that in sport at least, the authorities have been listening, or at least reacting. And the reason? In South Africa, I've hardly met a sportsman who didn't acknowledge that it's the boycott, South Africa's stage-by-stage exclusion from most international sport, that has provided the catalyst for this. It's a boycott that has become the cause of deep bitterness and frustration to some black sportsmen as well as white. President of the South African Olympic Association, Rudolf Opperman.
The world sees fit to use sport to indicate their displeasure with apartheid, or the worst elements of what is remaining of apartheid. And to me, that is an absolute abuse of sport, which should, and the British told us that, that sport should be played for the sake of sport and not to be abused for political ends.
It's not just Rudolf Opperman and other sports administrators, but the South African government itself, who are now engaged in a no-holds-barred campaign to break that boycott. Sport in the Republic, they argue, is already integrated. And where the laws of apartheid might otherwise prevent this, sport has been granted special exemptions. It is free to go its own way. Now, you may not approve of or believe in boycotts, but let's be absolutely clear why South Africa is banned from international sport. It's not banned because of its record on human rights, but we play sport with countries that have a far worse record, countries like Chile, Argentina, and the Soviet Union. No, they are banned by sport itself, and they are unique for being banned in that way and have been since 1970. Simply because sport is based on the ethos of play and competition being fair and equal for all. Opportunities have to be fair and equal for all. And that is not deemed possible in this country which practices apartheid.
So, Aaron, I thought that sort of framing by, I think it was, he was actually a sports commentator as well as a BBC journalist. The man sort of presenting that documentary, that framing was interesting because he's saying the boycott of apartheid South Africa wasn't just because there are things about apartheid South Africa we don't like. It's because the things we don't like about apartheid South Africa sort of inevitably impacted their sort of practice when it came to sports. So they're saying we can't allow a segregated by race team to enter the Olympics. Therefore, you know, we're not really commenting on your government, we're commenting on how you do sports. It's interesting. You know, someone might say, well, that's an argument, that's why it was so different to Israel. But actually, the whole argument people make about Israeli apartheid, this is what's in, you know, Human Rights Watch, what's in Amnesty, what's in B'Tselem, is they say, in practice, everywhere from the river to the sea is Israel, because it's all controlled by the government. You know, it's functionally Israel. Like, it shouldn't be by law, it shouldn't be, but functionally it is. And so you could make the same argument, which is to say that, you know, the Israeli Eurovision contestant isn't a legitimate contestant because the people who live in Gaza and the people who live in the West Bank, which is in practice part of Israel, were unable to sort of apply to take part.
Yeah, I think it's a really interesting argument. I mean, there are some differences. So, for instance, there are a couple of million Israeli Arabs or Arabs who are Israeli citizens. So that would be a rebuttal to the idea that... you know, you have to be Jewish and you have to be of a Jewish heritage in order to represent Israel in sports. Secondly, I'm always ambivalent about this comparison of South Africa to Israel and therefore the exact same tactics and strategy will work. You know, I think the ratio of black to white or white to non-white, which often included non-black people, that ratio in South Africa was actually pretty significant, I think 1 to 7, maybe more. Whereas if you look at the population of Jewish Israelis, contra Palestinians, Arabs, and Israeli Arabs, it's about even. It's about 7 million each, more or less. So I wouldn't necessarily say, well, because it worked in South Africa, therefore it works in Israel, whether that's with regards to outcomes or even the strategies to get there. I mean, maybe it would. I'm not, you know, Nostradamus, but I think there's some pretty key differences. Secondly, an Israeli or somebody who's an apologist for Israel would say, well, Israeli football teams, for instance, today, participate in UEFA competitions, and they have people from all racial backgrounds playing for those sides, including non-Arab, non-Israelis. The person, for instance, he's white European. One of the coaches for one of the top teams at Israel, but it doesn't say very much because they're not very good at football, is Robbie Keane, former Irish centre-forward. I think it's appalling he has that job, but he does. So they would say, well, actually, we're multicultural, you know, we're embracing people from all over. So I think it's indisputable what you've said there, Michael, is true. These aren't legitimate contestants for Israel in so much as there are large parts of Israel, de facto, Gaza at the West Bank, which are in no way represented in choosing them. I think that's very true. But I do also think there's some key differences. I think Israel is an ethno-state. I think that's absolutely, obviously the case. I think if you're defending Israel and think it's a legitimate way to run a society, you then come up against really hard barriers to defend multiculturalism against white nationalists in Europe, because they're essentially the same principles. Now, I understand as Zionists would say, well, because of historical reasons, with the exception, blah, 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 blah. You can make that argument, but it's nonetheless true. And there's a reason why many anti-Semites have also supported Zionism, because they don't want Jews in Europe. They want Jews to be somewhere else. So I get your logic, Michael. By the way, I completely support the sports boycotts. I think ideally Israel shouldn't be in international sports competition. My worry, though, with this sort of thing is that you stop Israel doing it, then you'd stop Iran, you'd stop Venezuela, and then, you know, the politics might change. You'd get rid of China. Well, if you don't have China, you don't have Russia, then of course those countries that support them or trade with them might not want to play or be in the Olympics anymore, and then they pull out, and then all of a sudden, really, you know, international sports competition doesn't mean international anymore. For me, that's a concern. So I think there has to be a very high threshold for saying you cannot participate in a sporting event. I think being actively at war and inflicting collective punishment and war crimes on civilian populations, I think clearly meets that threshold. I think that's the case with regards to Russia. I think that's the case with regards to Israel. And I think the solution with Russian sports people, for instance, in tennis, where you could have Russians participate in Wimbledon, but they weren't representatives of the Russian Federation. I don't know why you couldn't do that with Israel, for instance. I think that's a pretty elegant solution.
Let's go straight on to our next story. Small boat crossings of the English Channel have been back in the news this week. And that's because a record number of asylum seekers have crossed the Channel this year, or by this time this year, with over 4,500 people making the journey so far, according to Home Office figures. This is part of a wider trend that's seen the number of people claiming asylum in Britain grow sharply in the last few years. The total in 2022 almost reached the previous high in 2002. So back then, asylum claims surged as people fled wars in Somalia, Afghanistan, and Iraq. But small boat crossings in the early 2000s were almost non-existent. That new, more visible form of arrival only took off from 2018, in large part because of new and stronger security on the Eurotunnel, which had been the previously favoured method of crossing the Channel. And it's that visibility which has made small boat crossings a politically explosive topic. This was a Sky News report last summer after 686 migrants arrived in small boats in a single day.
Friday saw the highest number of migrants arriving into the UK after crossing the Channel in a single day so far this year. More than 600 men, women and children risked their lives to reach Britain's shores. Stopping the boats is now one of the Prime Minister's key priorities. And to cut the eye-watering £6.8 million a day hotel bill for housing asylum seekers, the government plans to use former military bases and airfields like this one in Wethersfield in Essex.
That was a report from July last year, and we can expect many more reports like that this year as we head into summer. Now, that's bad news for the Tories in an election year, especially after Sunak made stopping the boats one of his key pledges. And with the Rwanda plan on the rocks, there's a risk authorities look to more crude forms of deterrence. Earlier this week, French Border Force police were filmed apparently employing risky pushback techniques to stop a boat making the crossing to the UK, a vessel allegedly paid for by the UK as part of a deal with French authorities, makes several close passes to the dinghy, as you can see in this clip here. It's a method that campaigners say puts lives in danger. In another video, French authorities are seen employing other heavy-handed methods. Pulling up next to a small boat, the French police threaten those on board with pepper spray unless they turn back. Other methods reportedly used include ramming boats at sea and puncturing inflatables, which does force migrants to swim back to shore. It goes without saying, this makes an already very dangerous route even more dangerous. This year, 9 people have already drowned in the channel, the last being a 7-year-old girl. That's compared to 12 deaths across the whole of 2023. Since 2015, around 200 people are thought to have died making the crossing. The other form of deterrence the government has focused on is essentially making the lives of asylum seekers miserable if they are successful in getting here. Those seeking asylum in Britain can currently wait years for their applications to be processed, with massive backlogs having been allowed to develop in the system over recent years. And though there have been recent improvements, there are still over 100,000 people waiting to receive a decision on their claim. And while waiting for their claims to be processed, asylum seekers are made to live in limbo. On first arrival, they're housed in processing centres. The facilities are generally designed for very short stays, but people can end up staying for weeks in cramped and overcrowded conditions. After that, asylum seekers are moved to temporary accommodation around the country with no right to work, no access to benefits, and no say in where they end up. And in recent years, that accommodation has taken the form of hotels, with 55,000 people living in them last summer. While there, single asylum seekers must share rooms and can be moved to new accommodation at any time. That means the breaking of social relations that people may have formed, and for families, children losing school places at short notice. And it's not only an unstable form of accommodation, it's costly too, with a price tag of £3.1 billion per year. Last autumn, the government pledged to end the use of hotel accommodation, promising to close 50 of them by January this year. But while some hotels have been closed, many asylum seekers have simply been moved to different ones. This is from a Sky report following asylum seekers' move from one of those closing hotels in January.
What's happening right now? Where are these men going?
These guys are moving from this hotel to another hotel, a bit further up north.
We watched as they left Kidderminster in taxis, then arrived 70 miles away at this hotel in Derbyshire, where they'll now be staying.
Sky spoke to one man who was moved between hotels by the Home Office. Hallo from Iraq has waited more than 2 years for his application to be processed.
Switching, so it doesn't change anything. Just wasting money, I think.
So why do you think you've been moved?
I think it's just because of the next election. So they want to tell the native people we sorted out the hotels.
It's hard to exaggerate the extent to which asylum has become a political football, and how worsening the condition of asylum seekers in the name of deterrence is regularly used to try to generate political capital. Last year, the government rented the Bibby Stockholm barge to house asylum seekers at a cost of £22 million. As of January, there were 320 people living on the ship. In December last year, one person housed on the ship died, reportedly by suicide. The government is also turning former military bases into asylum centres, like this one at Scampton in Lincolnshire, where 2,000 asylum seekers may be detained. But while these new forms of accommodation have the effect of worsening conditions for asylum seekers, they also aren't cheap. These asylum sites will cost £46 million more than hotels. That's according to the National Audit Office. And what about those who are granted refugee status? Well, even then, the system isn't much easier. Last November, The Guardian produced this report on the work of a refugee charity in Liverpool.
In the last 3 months, homelessness has increased dramatically. When you've been granted refugee status, you have to leave the accommodation within 7 days. It used to be before like 28 days. Even that 28 days wasn't enough. Instead of increasing the days, they decreased the days. Yeah.
So this is a local park here in Liverpool. It's not far from our center as well. Sometimes in this place you see people sleeping here, the rough sleeping. Those people are our clients.
I am Iranian, I'm refugee politic. And last night I could sleep there. Look at it. Bet.
By the time you are waiting for a refugee status, the prime time of your life passed. So that means your life is being destroyed.
when they come here, they came with the hope that can restart and rebuild their new life here. We should help them to engage in this community.
The government's rush to clear the asylum backlog that they allowed to build up has meant that people with newly granted refugee status have just 7 days to find somewhere to live. It's a policy that led to the number of refugees being rendered street homeless tripling in the second half of last year. Of course, the logic of deterrence means this grim situation might be considered a feature, not a bug, of our asylum system. But does that logic work? Is it really the case that if we make it miserable to be an asylum seeker or a refugee in Britain, less people will attempt to come here? Well, according to the Home Office, it's not. In a 2020 report, they found this: the role of welfare policies, economic factors, and labour market access as a potential drivers of migration to the UK is limited, as many asylum seekers have little to no understanding of current asylum policies and the economic conditions of a destination country. Many asylum seekers have no experience of a welfare state, and they expect to be able to work to support themselves. The Migration Observatory at the University of Oxford agrees, saying this: qualitative research in other countries has found that asylum seekers typically do not have a clear picture of what policies will face them after they arrive, and that perceptions of different destinations are formed based on higher level factors, such as a country's overall reputation as safe or welcoming. Research has found that the information that asylum seekers have is often inaccurate. They go on. Another study found that preventative migration policies, particularly those concerned with deterrence, appear to matter little to asylum seekers' choice of destination country. The qualitative research based on interviews with asylum seekers is in broad agreement that asylum policy, especially that concerning the treatment of asylum seekers after they arrive, is not likely to be a powerful tool for influencing individuals' decision making. And perhaps it's those findings that explain a government announcement earlier this week. The Home Office has launched a series of social media ads in Vietnam to deter small boat migrants. The ads are in Vietnamese, but this is part of an English version. It tries to burst expectations about life in the UK for asylum seekers by telling what it calls the real story of a Vietnamese asylum seeker in Britain. I thought life in the UK would be easy and I could send money home, it says. Living in the UK was very different to what I thought. It was very difficult to get work. In 2023, just over 1,000 Vietnamese people arrived in the UK on small boats. So even if this ad were effective, which seems somewhat unlikely, it won't do much to help Rishi Sunak achieve his dream of stopping small boats coming to Britain. Aaron, I want your thoughts on this. The Tories, they're responsible for a lot of policies that seem both cruel and dysfunctional. So, you know, they're mean and they don't work. Asylum perhaps tops the lot.
Yeah, I think that's right. You know, Rwanda costing several hundred million pounds and nobody's even been sent to Rwanda. I mean, it's almost a joke. And the funny thing is actually with Rwanda, which is, like you say, possibly the meanest policy of all the policies they have. And it's, of course, meant to appeal most of all to the hard right of the Tory voting base. It's precisely that policy which has become a shorthand for why those people don't like the Tories and won't vote for them. Interesting. You know, interesting that if you try and couch a policy as radically right-wing, authoritarian, dealing with, quote-unquote, the migrant problem, and then you fail to deliver, actually that has a huge downside. I think actually the Tories would be, they'd be doing better in terms of polling if they hadn't promised to stop the small boats and if they hadn't engaged in the Rwanda quote-unquote solution. And I'm not suggesting that their voters don't care about those things. They do care about those things. They probably have very different views on those things to what our audience, generally speaking, does here at Navarra Media. But trying to say that this right-wing solution, which you like, will work, and then not delivering on it, I think in many ways is probably worse than not doing anything at all. I think if Sunak had simply focused on bringing inflation down, bringing interest rates down, bringing NHS waiting lists down, and a couple of other key indices, which they probably will meet, I think if they'd done that, you know, they would be faring better, which isn't hard, right? Because lots of polls have them between 20 and 25%, some lower than that even, some even below 20%. So clearly as a sort of policy agenda, talking right, but they're not delivering, doesn't work for them. You know, I was giving a talk recently to a pretty hostile audience on the issue of migration alongside Matt Goodwin and Konstantin Kissin and Polly Toynbee as well on my side, although we had differences of opinion as well between us. And I said, look, the facts are that Priti Patel is on migration the most liberal British Home Secretary in history, because of course she had 1.3 million people come here net migration over 2 years. And that is sort of true on a purely quantitative basis. And it really wound people up. And my God, Michael, if you think that the left dislikes or hates the Tories, the right really hates them too. And it's precisely because of this combination, I think, of both mean and ineffective policies, which has really become synonymous with them as a political brand. There is an issue in terms of displaced people. And this will only get worse over the course of the 21st century because of climate change. And I find it strange that progressives or people on the left say, on the one hand, we could have hundreds of millions of climate refugees this century, I think quite likely. And then on the other hand, say, well, we don't need to prepare for that. We clearly do. I think we need a cross-European coordinated response and framework to people claiming asylum. I think at the very least, we also need to have a joined-up foreign policy with regards to minimizing displaced people in our near abroad. I say this to people on the right, they sort of start freaking out. You can't complain about Syrians coming here or Iraqis or Afghans coming here when our own foreign policy choices, particularly in regards to Afghanistan and Iraq, has made those situations worse. You cannot complain. I've heard this time after time. Iranians coming to the UK, and I'll be honest, Michael, some of them are economic migrants. Some are LGBT. Some might be facing repression of some kind. Maybe they're from a demographic minority in the country. But some are economic migrants. And I think this is key. It's very important to say that often people have several reasons for fleeing somewhere. It's not just one thing. And they're not saying, my economic situation is wonderful, but I'm LGBT. Or equally, their economic situation may be pretty good, but because they're from a minority, they have to leave regardless. So there tends to be a sort of a confluence of factors as to why somebody would leave. And it's a bit more, you know, sophisticated than we're often sort of led to believe in the media conversation. But some Iranians absolutely come to the UK as economic migrants, absolutely. And I would say to a right-winger who would say, see, Arab Astalian of our media is saying that Iranians come here as economic migrants, drop the sanctions. The West has sanctions on Iran to squeeze that country's economy to death. They are some of the harshest, most stringent sanctions in the history of humanity. They've been on that country for 40 years. If I was Iranian, I would do the same. If I was a young Iranian and I don't see any prospects for change, political change in my country, but also at the same time, economic stagnation forever, of course I'd leave. Many of the people whining about this would leave. So I think it's not the whole story. It's part of the story, though. We need, in our foreign policy choices, to think about, are we displacing people? We're seeing it right now in Israel, Palestine. 2.5 million people in Gaza could be displaced. That is the maximalist political agenda of Zionists. There are some people, senior people in Israeli politics, like Israel Katz, who's the foreign secretary, the foreign minister. He's what they, I think they call them an accessionist. You know, he thinks that Israel should have the West Bank and that maybe Egypt should have Gaza. Or some of Gaza. So millions of Palestinians should just go to Egypt. And if millions go to Europe, who cares? And I find it really puzzling that you've got people on the right in this country who drone on, wheeze on, whine on, have these asthma attacks about migration and asylum every single day of the week. They can't put two and two together. Oh, I'm supporting a country which may want to displace 2.5 million people in our near abroad. It's on the Mediterranean Sea. They will come to Europe, a great many number of them. So I know it's not the whole answer, Michael, but firstly, we need European cooperation. I know people on the right don't like those words. We need European cooperation around a fair asylum policy, which is fair also for the whole of not just the European Union, but Norway, Iceland, the UK too. We all need to pull our weight. And we also need a joined up foreign policy where we're not trying to destroy countries in our near abroad. Not just the Middle East and West Asia, as I just said, but also North Africa too. We have a vested interest, actually, in these countries doing economically very, very well. We do not want dysfunctional economies in our near abroad and people having to leave. Now, part of that is because of the global economic trading system. That's a big thing to change. Part of it, like I say, is because of things like sanctions and wars and occupation abroad. I think that's the easiest stuff to solve. And by the way, if Iran was opened up economically, if there was a space for political reform, many people would want to live in Iran. I know Iranians that live in Europe and would love to live in Iran. I'm not suggesting that Iran would inevitably go towards that if sanctions were dropped, because a great deal of that rests on the regime too and where it chooses to go. But I really think, Michael, it's a moment for the left actually to make the broader argument for migration policy, asylum policy in this country, and foreign policy abroad.
Are you enjoying this evening's show? Do you normally enjoy our shows? If so, and if you're not yet a supporter, please do consider becoming one. You can do that at navarromedia.com/support. This organization, this show, it is funded by the donations, the regular donations of our viewers. So if you are a regular supporter already, thank you so much. If not, please do go to navarromedia.com/support. Straight on to our final story now. I want to talk to you about artificial intelligence because a tweet earlier this week boosted concerns about AI taking jobs in the creative industries. Sarah Poyser stars in the stage production of Mamma Mia. She tweeted this, sobering. And then she's added Equity, which is the sort of performers union. Subject, re Sarah Poyser, sorry for the delay. We have had the approval from the BBC to use the AI-generated voice, so we won't need Sarah anymore. Now, this caused uproar among lots of voice actors online, and actually lots of people in the creative industries generally. The controversy was also written up in a bunch of newspapers saying, this is AI taking people's jobs. Lots of outrage, really, at the BBC by cutting costs for going for AI instead of real human beings. In fact, in this particular story, it seems like the controversy may have been based on a bit of a misunderstanding. So the BBC's press office tweeted this. We're aware there's been discussion in the last 24 hours regarding our use of AI in relation to voiceover work. There is some important context to this, which is explained here. And they say here, we are making a highly sensitive documentary which features a contributor who is nearing the end of life and is now unable to speak. We have been working closely with their family to explore how we might best represent the contributor's voice at the end of the film when words they have written are read out. In these very particular circumstances, and with the family's wishes in mind, we have agreed to use AI for a brief section to recreate a voice which can now no longer be heard. This will be clearly labelled within the film. That does, to me, seem like a pretty reasonable explanation. Of course, the clarification tweet from the BBC got a lot fewer views than the original post. I mean, this does seem like an honest misunderstanding. The competition, though, between creatives and generative AI will no doubt be something that intensifies in the near future. TV soaps, in fact, could be made with AI. That's what a leading director told Parliament's Culture Select Committee last month. James Hawes is vice chairman of Directors UK and director of the Apple TV spy drama Slow Horses. He told MPs this. We at Directors UK held a forum about Doctors, the BBC show that's been cancelled. One of the members there started talking about AI, and it sent me investigating how long it would be before a show like Doctors can be made entirely by generative AI. I took a poll with various visual effects people and spoke to some of the legal team who advised the Screen Actors Guild, that's the United States Union, and the Writers Guild over the summer. The best guess is within 3 to 5 years. Hawes believes AI will create scripts which are good enough for soaps. So like Doctors, I suppose he's chosen sort of generic, removing the need for writers. But he also thinks it's possible that AI could create passable footage and potentially removing the need for actors and camera operators. He pointed to Sora, so this is a new program from OpenAI, as an example of the advances being made in this sector. So Sora is not yet available to the general public, not like ChatGPT where you can give it your own commands, but OpenAI have released stunning examples of footage it can create when given certain prompts. Aaron, as I say, so we started this section with what does seem like a bit of a misunderstanding between a voice actor and the BBC, but the possibility for AI to just radically, I mean, destroy jobs in the creative industry, frankly, because there's lots of, you know, technical jobs, graphic design, visual effects, which I think is quite labor intensive up to now. I mean, if you can do it all by AI, that's going to destroy a lot of jobs or create a lot of like mid-level content, because now everyone can make a film that looks like it was done by Pixar.
Or a bit of both, right? I mean, that's what happened with media over the last 25 years. I find this really interesting, Michael. You know, 50, 60 years ago, being a journalist was viewed as a very prestigious, high status, believe it or not, a very well-paid job. It was. I mean, there are still some of those, not many, you know, really like probably less than 10% when you compare it to the sort of high point, particularly print media, let's say the midpoint of the century. It's probably a sweet spot where both print and broadcast was very healthy, maybe late 60s, early 70s. And today we don't live in that world anymore. The idea that you could make a really great living off writing, some people can, you know, the top 5-10% of people can. I mean, Novara survives, but nobody is saying that like people that work at Novara will be living like millionaires. You know, if you think about something like Andrew Neil, he came at the end of that revolution, the editor of the Sunday Times during the 1980s. You know, he owns like a summer house in France. He has an apartment in New York. He has a place in Chelsea, London. Like lots of people of that age cohort and older live like that because of the media industries and because of journalism. Those days have gone, even for the successful ones today. And I find it interesting that in 30, 40 years time, people might say the same thing about actors. You know, wow, there were people like Tom Cruise or Brad Pitt, and they were paid millions, tens of millions of dollars per film. Isn't that crazy? They were just pretending to be somebody else, and hey, I can do that. And you might think I'm being facetious, but I genuinely think that we will be reflecting on this present moment as an inflection point for certain jobs, like you say, particularly in the creative industries, but other ones too: accountancy, legal services, medical services, research, where actually AI is going to be really, really, really game-changing. You know, we've been accustomed to the idea for a very long time that technological change is really a problem for blue-collar workers. Robots, automation is laying off automotive workers in Detroit or Dagenham. We make more cars than ever before, but with fewer people. Sorry, steel workers. You know, Bruce Springsteen complaining about it. Partly those jobs were going abroad, but also partly they were being automated. But actually in the 2020s, 2030s, 2040s, the front line of technological change and automation and technological unemployment is going to be white-collar jobs, the ones I just said. We were fed a lie, really, 15, 20 years ago, that the future of work is creative. Nonsense. This is the very first stuff which is now going to be automated as a result of things like generative AI. And in terms of creating a TV product like Doctors, I mean, it's such a great example, Michael, or Neighbours. You know, the scripts for those shows were so poor. I totally believe that, you know, the successor of ChatGPT in 10 years' time, Max, could write something better, actually. I mean, they were formulaic, identikit crap most of the time. They weren't award-winning TV, you know, prestige TV that was going to win an Emmy. It wasn't Succession. So I think actually lots of mid-ranking dialogue in films, TV, loads of that's clearly going to be automated. Now, does that mean we won't have script writers? No, that doesn't mean we'll have no script writers. What it means is that today a team of 10 script writers will probably be a team of 2 or 3 script writers in 10 years' time. So you'll still have script writers. There'll just be far fewer of them. And I suspect that will be the case right throughout that industry. You'll still have, you know, visual effects people, you'll still have editors, etc. But actually, it'll be a hybrid formula of both man and machine, humans and machines, and far more capital intensive over time. So more and more machine over time. That's going to lead to a surge in productivity. It's really good. And it's going to lower the costs of new entrants into markets. People will be able to make something that looks like Game of Thrones for a fraction of the price, probably in like 10, 15 years' time, which is obviously good, but it's also going to mean significant amounts of unemployment. And this is a problem, like I say, right across our economy, but particularly in white-collar jobs, particularly in things like driving, self-driving cars, self-driving vehicles, autonomous vehicles is on the same trajectory here. Now, you might think, Aaron, don't be silly. Tesla, they're all blowing up all the time. They're killing people. Well, they are today. But bear in mind, every year in the United States, around 30,000 people die in car accidents. If you can demonstrate that only 15,000 people would die because of autonomous vehicles, you move from a situation where it's preferable to have maybe autonomous vehicles to it being a moral imperative. Well, half as many people would die if we stopped humans from driving cars. How on earth could you oppose it? That's where we're going to, I think, in the next 10 to 15 years. So this is a huge challenge to our economic model. It's going to massively increase inequality, both regional and between individuals. It's going to prove massively disruptive to a whole bunch of industries. I mean, I was asked this, Michael, a few days ago, actually, speaking to some young students. And I said, Novara started in 2010. Today it has about like 25, 30 people. In 10 years, you could probably create something similar-ish with 5 people, 10 people, maybe 10 people, let's say, half talent, half not talent, i.e. people speaking, or I don't think I'm talented, but that's the word in the industry, people speaking or talking or writing, and then you have those supporting them, finance, HR, editor, producer, etc. I think because of AI, in just 10 years, a project like Navara would go from, say, 30 members of staff to 10. I think that's coming. And yeah, we need a political settlement and a political project fundamentally to address that. That's why I wrote the book that I did, Fully Automated Luxury Communism, because these trends are not disappearing. If anything, they're going to accelerate, particularly in the creative industries.
Let's go to some different opinions. Oliver Kant with a super chat. AI boosters do not understand art at all. And someone who at the moment agrees is Charlie Brooker, TV writer. He isn't too impressed with ChatGPT's current abilities. He's tried to make a series of Black Mirror with the AI tool, but said this about its capabilities. All it's done is look up all the synopses of Black Mirror episodes and sort of mush them together. Then if you dig a bit more deeply, you go, oh, there's not actually any real original thought here. Of course, that might be the case now, but when you look at the speed of the advance with these kind of tools, it might not be the case in a couple of years' time. And advancements are coming thick and fast in the music industry too. Suno is a new platform that allows you to make pretty reasonable sounding tracks with a simple prompt. It does it within about 60 seconds. It is quite magical. Today, I gave it a prompt that speaks to me. This is, quote, a country song about working on Bank Holiday Friday, hosting a YouTube political news show.
Sitting at my desk on a Bank Holiday Friday. Got my cowboy boots and my coffee in hand. The sun is shining, but I'm stuck inside, hosting a YouTube show in this political land. Got my mic and my camera ready to go. Gotta talk about the news, give them all the facts. But all I really wanna do is kick back and relax. Sipping on a cold one, leaving it all in the past. Bank holiday blues got me feeling down. Working on a Friday when the world's spinning round. But I'll keep on sharing the truth, one story at a time. Trying to make a difference in this crazy political grind.
Uncanny. Uncanny. If I had been a singer-songwriter, that's exactly the song I would have written today, but obviously AI could do it for me. I did the next song in honor of a Twitter beef that Aaron got himself into this week. So I want to know if he enjoys this song. The tweet was in response to a pretty horrible viral video of someone wielding a knife on a train. And Aaron said this, appalling. I'd be interested to know how many people can watch this and still think we shouldn't have guards on trains to call the British Transport Police and have this individual detained at the next stop for one. Now, that's the kind of statement that wouldn't be controversial anywhere in the world, except on left Twitter. And people got pretty annoyed with Aaron for supposedly being pro-cop. I, of course, thought he handled it well. And I share those views about guards on trains. And this is my song for you, Aaron. The prompt is a song about a communist who wants more police on trains in the style of UK Garage.
Coming through with a communist view. I got a plan, God share with you. On this train, we're all the same. But we need more police to ride this train. In this world, equality's the key. But sometimes things get a little crazy. With more police, we can keep the peace. Making sure everyone's journey's free. Coming through with a communist view.
Quite good, right? This is better than the country one I did. What do you think?
Banger.
It is a banger. The garage one is really, really good. And I actually kind of agreed, because I agree with your take on trains, and I think they expressed it really well. You know, sometimes you need guards, police, to keep the peace on a train so everyone can travel easily. You know, obviously, there's going to be some downsides. Maybe I could have asked it to also include some of the downsides of police, but I think it did pretty well with the prompt I gave it.
That'd be pretty Michael Walker, like, you know, But it, you know, integrate some counter arguments.
Yeah, add some nuance, please.
No, I think it's interesting. It's like the whole two-step thing. That's maybe more prone to automation because a lot of garage is more of a formula. But I guess there is for country too. In terms of what Charlie Brooker said, Michael, ChatGPT isn't replacing scriptwriters right now. Like we know that. That's nobody's suggesting that. The point is, what's the trajectory? And what I would say is, original screenwriting is not going to disappear in the next 10 years. What's going to disappear is the copy editing, the proofreading. Like I've written a first draft, please iterate it to improve syntax and to make this character more X. Like that's very, I think, likely, close to certain, actually. Somebody said in the comments, this is all a grift like NFT and, you know, crypto or whatever. I mean, PricewaterhouseCooper, I think in 2015, said that by 2035, the world economy would add about $13 trillion worth of value as a result of AI. And actually, I think today, this week, there's a story in the FT about how AI is now driving, albeit speculative, gains in company market capitalization prices in the United States because they're going to add a ton of value. And it means you're going to be able to lay lots of people off and reduce costs. And you'll be able to keep your present revenues, which means your costs to projected revenues are improving. You're going to make more money. You're more profitable. Great. We're going to value even more because AI is going to work. And yes, AI steals stuff. It steals shit. Capitalism steals shit. That's the basis of capitalism. It appropriates nature. It appropriates gendered labor, i.e. women, generally speaking, rearing children who are future workers. It doesn't pay them to do that. It appropriates labor. It alienates a certain part of your labor from you in order to make a profit. That's not new. You know, Marx was saying that's 150 years ago. So yeah, AI steals a bunch of shit. You know, capitalism has stolen a bunch of shit. Still, if you tried to stop it, people got upset. So this is going to be contested, isn't it? You know, we saw that recently with the Screenwriters Guild, rather, who went on strike. And one of the demands of their strike in California was that AI wouldn't be able to base future models on their work. They wouldn't permit AI to use drafts even of scripts they'd written in order to improve its own output. To improve its algorithms. So this is all going to be politically contested. Nobody's saying it's quote unquote inevitable, but that's the direction. And so workers have to respond. They have to think about the kind of world that they would want to build. Okay, well, there's also some possibilities here, right? What kind of society would you like if, okay, 50% of the economy actually required a quarter of as many people as it does right now? I think realistically, because we're an aging society, many more people will have to work in elderly care. I think we're going to have many more people work in care generally. Many people are going to have to work in building a post-carbon economy, at least in the medium term. But I think probably also it's going to be the basis of a four-day week. I think that to me is a sensible political agenda for the next 15 years. And I talked about it in a TED talk I gave a couple of years ago. That's my view. I wouldn't say that AI is like NFTs and crypto. I mean, look, that was a fad and that was nonsense. I mean, crypto probably has some use cases, not many. It's certainly not, you know, an equivalent of the steam engine in the 21st century, which I think AI probably is.
Yeah, I mean, I'd say in terms of sort of genuine revolutionary potential when it comes to our productive capacity, it's definitely AI, then crypto, then NFTs, right at the bottom. NFTs being non-fungible tokens, where you could get a sort of monkey cartoon, which no one else could own, even though it was a digital item. Didn't make any sense. Aaron Vastani, thank you so much for joining me this evening.
My pleasure, Michael. NFTs, remember them? Anyway, yeah, it was a great show. And to everybody watching, listening, have a wonderful Easter. Have a very restorative weekend. If you are working, I hope you don't work too hard. And to you too, Michael. Have a nice Easter.
Thank you very much. Thank you all for tuning in. Make sure to come back at 6 p.m. on Monday. We will be here on Bank Holiday Monday as well. You've been watching Navarra Media. Good night.
This broadcast is brought to you by Navarra Media. Go to navarramedia.com/support.